Well, let me tell you one thing. It is very nice to be here again. I should really try to come more often than every year, shouldn't I? I'm so cheap. I only come when they pay my ticket to come to on the Eurostar. So we have, what verse do we have? Particular verse? 324, that's right. Oh, nice. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Utsidayur ime loka nakuryam karma ched aham. Utsidayur ime loka. Utsidayur ime loka. Nakuryam karma ched aham. Na kuryam karma ched aham. Sankarasya cha karta syam. Sankarasya cha karta syam. Sankarasya cha karta syam. Upahanyam ima prajaha. Upahanyam ima prajaha. Utsidayor ime loka. Nakuryam karma cheddaham. Sankarasya chakaratasyam. Upahanyam ima praja. Utsiddeyor ime loka. Nakuryam karma chedaham. Sankarasya chakaratasyam. Upahanyam ima praja. Utsideyu would be put into ruin. Ime, all these. Loka, worlds. Na, not. Kuryam, I perform. karma, prescribed duties. Chet, if. Aham, I. Sankarasya, of unwanted population. Cha, and. Karata, creator. Syam, would be. Upahanyam, would destroy. Ima, all these. Praja, living entities. If I did not perform prescribed duties, all these worlds would be put to ruination. I would be the cause of creating unwanted population, and I would thereby destroy the peace of all living beings. Please repeat. If I did not perform prescribed duties, all these worlds would be put to ruination. I would be the cause of creating unwanted population, and I would thereby destroy the peace of all living beings. Purport. Varna Sankara is unwanted population, which disturbs the peace of the general society. In order to check this social disturbance, there are prescribed rules and regulations by which the population can automatically become peaceful and organized for spiritual progress in life. When Lord Krishna descends, naturally he deals with such rules and regulations in order to maintain the prestige and necessity of such important performances. The Lord is the Father of all living entities, and if the living entities are misguided, indirectly the responsibility goes to the Lord. Therefore, whenever there is general disregard of regulative principles, the Lord himself descends and corrects the society. We should, however, note carefully that although we have to follow in the footsteps of the Lord, we still have to remember that we cannot imitate him. Following and imitating are not on the same level. We cannot imitate the Lord by lifting Govardhan Hill, as the Lord did in his childhood. It is impossible for any human being. We have to follow his instructions, but we may not imitate him at any time. The Srimad Bhagavatam 10:33-30-31 affirms, Naitat samacharaj jatu manasapi hyanishwaraha vinashyatyacharan modyad yatarudro di jangvisham ishwaranam vacha satyam tataiva charitam kwachit tesham yatsva vacho yuktam budimangs tat samacharat. One should simply follow the instructions of the Lord and his empowered servants. Their instructions are all good for us, and any intelligent person will perform them as instructed. However, one should guard against trying to imitate their actions. One should not try to drink the ocean of poison in imitation of Lord Shiva. We should always consider the position of the Ishwaras, or those who can actually control the movements of the sun and moon, as superior. Without such power, one cannot imitate the Ishwaras, who are super powerful. Lord Shiva drank poison to the extent of swallowing an ocean. But if any common man tries to drink even a fragment of such poison, he will be killed. There are many pseudo-devotees of Lord Shiva who want to indulge in smoking ganja, marijuana, and similar intoxicating drugs, forgetting that by so imitating the acts of Lord Shiva, they are calling death very near. Similarly, there are some pseudo-devotees of Lord Krishna who prefer to imitate the Lord in his Rasa Lila, or Dance of Love, forgetting their inability to lift Govardhan Hill. It is best, therefore, that one not try to imitate the powerful, but simply follow their instructions, nor should one try to occupy their posts without qualification. There are so many so-called incarnations of God without the power of the Supreme Godhead. Om Agyanati Manandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. This is sort of strange, because in one part of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is asking the question. He's saying, if I fight, then there's going to be a problem. Because the men are going to die, and then the families are going to be destroyed. So it's better that I don't do that, because if the families are destroyed, then the offspring of those women without husbands are just going to grow up as unwanted people. They're going to be psychologically disturbed. They're going to be some unhelpful patterns in society that develop as a result of this war. War causes problems. It causes psychological trauma. So Arjuna is saying to Krishna, why should I engage in this war? It's horrible, it's ghastly. And even if I do win, even if I do win this war, it's also going to be not very helpful, because I'll be there. How can I possibly enjoy anything if everything that I have achieved by fighting is tainted with blood? So he seems to be making a moral, social argument to not engage in war. So Krishna says, you know, he gives him a counter argument. But then here in 324, Krishna seems to be saying, well, actually, everyone has to do their duty so that there can be peace within society. Okay? So it seems that Krishna wants peace in society. And he wants that everybody follow their dharma. So there seems to be a conflict here between what Krishna says in the early part of the Gita and just a few minutes later. Krishna is using a different argument. But actually, when Krishna speaks, he speaks for the ultimate good of the entire world. Because he uses so many different arguments on Arjuna. And each time he expects Arjuna to listen very carefully. Krishna uses he tries to stir Arjuna into military behavior on the grounds that he is a kshatriya and he should therefore fight. And then he tries to stir him into a spiritual mood by saying that actually, even if you're fighting, then of course no one is ultimately killed. But then he says here is everyone must do their duty, and even I must do my duty when I come to this world. For if I didn't do my duty, then there would be a problem, because people would try to follow me. So he's saying here that the whole world is put into ruin if they don't follow prescribed duties. Now, the translation for prescribed duties is karma. Normally, as devotees, we use the word karma as meaning when you do something bad that's against bhakti yoga. And we use the derogative term karmi as, you know, someone who's, you know, someone, I don't know whether we still do, but we used to. There's karmis, oh, the karmis, meaning the non-devotees, like the infidels or something like that. But karmi actually means a person who's performing prescribed duties according to the Vedas. Give them a break, you know. They're very good people. Krishna says here he wants lots of karmis. It says it in this verse. Krishna is saying, I want lots of karmis to do their duty. It's right here in the verse. Because karma means they act according to the Vedas. But because most of the Vedas have to do with promoting to the heavenly planets, then most karmis are selfishly interested and don't have much of an interest in pure bhakti. But they do have an interest in the life after this one being a very successful life and enjoying the fruits of good karma. So what is good karma? Well, good karma is not Krishna consciousness specifically. Good karma is worshipping the Matarishva. Matarishva is the Ishwaras, the ones who control the various movements within this world. Each of us is, Prabhupada, he describes that each of us is being moved like a football is kicked. like a football is kicked. A football is kicked by a young boy, and it sails through the air. And then when it falls to the ground, it's being kicked again. And Prabhupada said, sometimes when the ball is sailing through the air, the ball is thinking, I'm free. I'm enjoying. I'm flying through the air. But Prabhupada said, no, he's being kicked every time. So sometimes the concept of freedom is there when one is enjoying. Actually one is under control at every time. And then the final control is old age and disease and finally death. We're firmly in the grip. And so much of what we choose to do, even our political thoughts or the way we fight, sometimes you get taken by surprise. You might go to India or something and have your Jyotish, you meet a Jyotish and you have your chart done. And you find that astrologically, this is supposed to happen and it's happening right now. You're right in the middle of it. And you thought that you were a free agent. But actually you find that your habits and your choices and your preferences in life are controlled in different ways. Once I had a conversation with a man in a hospital. I was living in Africa. He was an Indian. And his father had just passed away in a car accident. And this young man, who was the son, he had his head bandaged like this. And he said, I always knew this was going to happen. I said, how can you know when your father's going to die? He said, my father told me. He said, how could your father know what's going to happen to him? He said, when my father got married 30 years ago, he went to India. And he wanted to know one question, amongst other questions. He wanted to know, when am I going to die? When is it likely that I'm going to die? So someone said 60. And he went to another one. He said, 61. And the third person said, maybe 60, maybe 61. And before he came to the end of his 59th year, he called all his family. And he said, okay, I want you to know that I'm going to go very soon. And I want you to take over the business. I want you to do the bookkeeping. I want you to do the import and export. I want you to do the advertising. I want you to get that warehouse. And he sorted out all his business. And a few weeks later, he was traveling with his son, and the car hit a bump in the road and rolled over a few times and landed in a ditch, and he was gone. So he finished up his business in this world because he actually believed that the duration of my life is controlled, and you can't say that it was a death wish. No one has a death wish. No one in Satvaguna. You don't find that people in Satvaguna have death wishes. You see, we don't find that. Not too much. Maybe some rare cases. But people who are in Satvaguna, they have a tendency to look very positively in life and to see a bright future for themselves. But at the same time, now sometimes people may say, well, I don't think you should depend on an astrologer for these things because I don't think it's true. You see? When someone goes to the doctor, and you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, I see that you have you have this problem, and you better be very careful because in 3 weeks' time, this is going to get really infected. You see? If you don't take the antibiotics, in 3 weeks' time this is going to be really infected. And so someone says, who are you? Who are you? How can you predict the future? Are you an astrologer? Or how do you know what's going to happen in the future? Do you have a time machine? You can go through time into 3 weeks in the future and see what's going to happen? Why should I trust you? So the doctor says, okay, you don't have to. I'm giving you my wisdom because my experience tells me this is going to happen. So then 3 weeks later, the person comes back and says, how did you know? How did you know? You see? The doctor says, you were displaying symptoms. And I know how long a symptom takes to develop into a very extreme symptom. It's called intelligence. Prabhupada told a story about a man who was sitting on the branch of a tree. You know the story. He's sitting on the branch of the tree. He's cutting through the branch of the tree. The trunk is here. He's sitting on the branch. And the man looks up and he says, my friend. He says, what do you want? Well, if you keep cutting like this, you'll break the branch. You're sitting on the branch, you'll fall. He said, how do you know? He said, how can you tell the future? Prabhupada said, this man, he's in the mode of ignorance. He can't tell the future because he doesn't know the future consequences of his present action. So, and he falls. And then he looks up at the man and he says, how did you know that? So Prabhupada said, he said, if you're intelligent, he said, you'll know the future. By my present activities, you know what the future is going to go. But he says, this is sattva-gun. Nikita, Haribol. This sattva-gun means that I know the future by what I'm doing now. That's sattva-guna. Passion means I don't know the future and I don't care. See? Ignorance means what future? Only as important as now. So these are the different modes. So we can see into the future. Krishna gives that ability to see into the future by the mode that we're in. So here he's saying that he does want karmis. And of course, by the end of the book, we find that Krishna wants bhaktis. He wants bhakti yogis. But here he says, look, I come into this world and I perform prescribed duties. It's a prescription. When you go to the doctor, he gives you a prescription. Okay? And the prescription says, take 3 of these every day after meals for 2 weeks. It's a prescription. It's a prescribed activity. So the doctor's more intelligent than you. The only reason you go to a doctor is he has more intelligence about your body. So how can a doctor know more about you than you? Well, maybe you're not so unique. Maybe you're just like every other human being. Maybe your liver is pretty much the same as anybody else's liver. Maybe your stomach is just the same as anybody else's stomach. You see? It's like the devotee who wrote to Srila Prabhupada from America. And Prabhupada sent him a reply, some guidance. And then the devotee met Prabhupada in Vrindavan. And he said, Prabhupada, I wrote to you from America, and you wrote me a reply, and it said, read my books, get up early in the morning, go on Sankirtan, and chant all my rounds. But I've come here to Vrindavan all the way from America because I wanted your personal instructions. And Prabhupada said, yes, I will give you my personal instructions. Read my books, get up in the morning, go on Sankirtan and chant your rounds. He said. But he said, Prabhupada, I know that's an instruction that you give to everybody. Is it an instruction just for me? You know, my personal instruction? You know, my guru, Dave? He said, yes. Read my books, get up in the morning. So he wanted to stress to him at that point. He wanted to stress to him, you're nothing special. You're one disciple amongst 5,500 disciples. And my instructions are for all of my disciples. They're for everyone. Because everyone has the same problems. Everyone has the same attachments. Everyone has the same ignorance and passion that they're trying to overcome. So in the same way, these are prescribed activities that Krishna prescribes through the words of the Vedas. Now, you know, most of us don't have a problem with that because we were never exposed to the prescriptions of the Vedas. But there are very close rules for everybody to follow. You know, the sutras do this. And being a sutra is not a bad thing. Sometimes when we read Prabhupada's books, it's, these are sutras. And we have it in this verse as well. These are sutras. The sutras take shelter of the demigods. And I'm giving class again in the morning. And Prabhupada in the purport in the Bhagavatam says, the sutras take shelter of Bhadrakali and try to make human offerings. You see? So the point is, on the one hand we say, the sutras. But at the same time, Krishna wants the sutras to behave like sutras. This is the point. There will always be sutras in society. There will always be kshatriyas. There will always be brahmins. And what's the other one? The vaishyas. There will always be these people, and Krishna expects them to all perform according to their nature. It is not that somebody who's, you know, the president of the country or the king tells you your Varnashram identity. Not like that. That's the current system that we have. You know, actually, many people cannot perform their current Varnashram identity because they're all heaped into cities. We're heaped into cities serving the machinery of the modern state and the modern world and the machinery of production and many other modern inventions that are good for a few people and not good for the many. But Prabhupada said that man invents the city and God invented the village. So ideally, we're meant to be in villages. This is human size industry, human scale industry. You know, producing a turnip is more important than producing nuts and bolts, Prabhupada said at one time. He said, because you cannot eat nuts and bolts, but you can eat vegetables. So farming is the most noble activity. Any farmers here? Any gardeners? That's because I'm looking at you. So there must be people to perform all these different activities in society. Society must be organized along the lines of the Vedic injunctions. Vedic injunctions is so that in the next life, Sudras can become Vaishyas, and the Vaishyas can become Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriyas can become Brahmins, and the Brahmins can become Yogis. So five lifetimes. If you think that's a long time, I can tell you that it's not a very long time. I can tell you that you've had many, many, many more lifetimes than that. All of us, many, many more lifetimes. So hopefully this is our last lifetime, but we've worked in so many ways, we've had so many names, so many wives, so many husbands. Think of that. Isn't it time that we went back to Godhead and gave it all up? Such a problem for us. But there is prescription. Who is prescribing? God is prescribing. So we've sort of bypassed that. When you come to the Krishna consciousness movement, no one says to you, you're going to sit with the temple president and he's going to help you decide your varna, what varna you fit into. We don't sort of do that. We fit everybody into the one varna. We say, oh, you're all Brahmins. And Prabhupada said sometimes, not everybody is Brahmin. Not everybody is Brahmin. He said at one point, he said, do not be so quick to make everybody Brahmins. He said, not everybody should be Brahmin. Brahmin has qualities, cleanliness, intelligence, sattva guna, like that. So our movement also needs all different types of devotees, and a devotee can appear in any varna. But just because you're a devotee may not mean that you give up your varna, because we like to do certain things. And then we do those for Krishna. You notice here that Krishna is not getting Arjuna to give up his varna. He's getting to become Krishna conscious, but within his varna. And Krishna, he's alongside Arjuna in that varna. See? Krishna's looking after the horses. He wasn't just the chariot driver. He was looking after the horses. At the end of the day, Krishna had to wipe down the horses, because some of them had blood. He had to see to their injuries. He had to give them food. He had to give them fresh bedding so they could go to sleep. And only when Krishna had looked after the horses, then he was able to go and eat himself. So Krishna takes on that position. He acts in that position. When he's chosen to be a chariot driver, he performs expertly the business of the chariot driver. He doesn't get to a point at the end of the day where he says, actually, Arjuna, you know the other day when, I showed you my universal form? Well, you know, do you really think I should be, you know, mucking out the horses and cleaning them and putting fresh straw down? I mean, don't you know who I am? I'm God. Can't you find someone else to look after your horses for you? No, because Krishna is performing the prescribed duties of a sarathi, a chariot driver. So he does that because he shows how when you have a prescribed duty, you have to execute it. You see? And sometimes our devotees sometimes become a little confused because we don't have a varna. Someone has told you you're a Brahmin, but you can't actually work as a Brahmin. You don't like it. Sometimes you want to do something else. Sometimes devotees want to be a businessman or a businesswoman. They don't want to make flower garlands for the rest of their life. Okay? Some people don't. Don't laugh. Some people, they want to do what they want to do, you know. We have one of our devotees, and he wants to start schools. So he's starting schools. So we have another devotee who wants to be a politician. They want to be a politician. So now it's a little easier to be what you want to be. Because years ago, we all lived together. We all looked the same, dressed the same, ate the same, spoke the same. We all had the same piece of string, and we were all Brahmins. Okay? Well, that was hopeful, wasn't it? It was hopeful. But actually, individuality has a way of coming out. And we all come out of the Brahminical closet. And we show who we are after some time. So the thing is that you may want to be a particular type of person, but be a particular type of person for Krishna. So here we have a situation where Krishna is saying, look, when I come to this world, I come and I show people how to behave because that's my job. I want a peaceful society. And that's why we're having the Battle of Kurukshetra, in order to establish peace. Because these other people don't want peace and they're the bad guys. So we're going to have a battle. When the battle is finished, there's going to be some trauma for everybody. But at the same time, human society will be peaceful. And human society can be peaceful when everyone is following their particular roles. And in those roles, there are set rules. We have a culture in our Vaishnava Dharma of no hard and fast rules, isn't it? Pretty much. No hard and fast rules. You can chant Hare Krishna anywhere. Except around the you can chant Hare Krishna anywhere and to any piece of music and using any instrument, we have some pretty set hard and fast rules for what time to get up in the morning and rituals about offering flowers and doing puja. There's a lot of rules there. So we say that there's no hard and fast rules for chanting Hare Krishna, but everything around the chanting of Hare Krishna, there's a lot of hard and fast rules. Of course, you can do puja in your home as you wish, okay? But still there's rules to follow. A lot of rituals also. We do a lot of rituals. One academic, she came to Bhaktivedanta Manor and she was interviewing the devotees. She was with us during, she was making a film of, the morning program with a TV company. And she was interviewing the devotees and she was seeing that all the devotees, they all get up at the same time. They all come down at the same time. They all bow down in front of the altar. Then they all dance pretty much the same way. They all sing the same song. They all do this, Kala Mrityu Haranam Sarva Vyadi Vinashanam. Then they come off about Shri Guru Chara. They all do this at the same time. They all sit down. Saridara Vijajal Jirandiyagdegal. They all eat at the same time. And it's the same thing every day. So she was saying to the devotees, could you explain a little bit about your rituals? And the devotees said, we don't do rituals. Our life is not about rituals, it's about service to Krishna. No, she said, the rituals that you do in the morning program. She said, and the devotees were actually saying, those aren't rituals. They're not rituals. That's a manifestation of love for Krishna and Prabhupada. They're not rituals. Because the devotees think that by ritual, you mean something where you don't know what you're doing. You're doing it's empty of meaning, and it's just a repetitive action. And so she came to me, she said, look, can you explain? The devotees are doing rituals, but they're telling me that they're not doing rituals. What's going on? I said, look, I said, do you know the story of the Chinese goldfish? She said, no, tell me. Is it an ISKCON story? I said, no, it's another story. I said, there was a Chinese goldfish, you know, just swimming in the water. And the monk came to him and he said, how's the water? And the goldfish looked up. And the goldfish said, what water? I don't see any water. Looking around him. I said, when you're completely surrounded by something, you don't even notice it's there. I said, so you ask them, they're completely surrounded by ritual. Even how many inches the hair is supposed to be cut at the back and exactly what the, you know, the thread is meant to be made of and how many circles around their neck, the beads are supposed to go and everything's ritual. I said, but they've translated the word ritual as to mean empty, meaningless, repetitive activity. She's, and also, they don't even see the ritual because everybody's doing it. They don't notice it. They're swimming in that ritual all the time. For them, it's not there. But everything that we do is ritual. Everything that we do is ritual. So what is this business of no hard and fast rules? Well, what it actually means is that there's hard and fast rules for chanting every other mantra. Just like Gayatri Mantra. You're supposed to chant Gayatri Mantra at just before sunset, at midday, and sunrise, Prabhupada said. You see? And that's the way to do it. And then you're supposed to have bath first. You're supposed to do Achman before you chant Gayatri. You're supposed to look towards the eastern direction. You're supposed to sit cross-legged in the evening. But in the morning and at noontime, you're supposed to be standing up. These are hard and fast rules. If you chant Gayatri at the wrong time of day, it's not proper. Devotees do it because they think, no hard and fast rules. There's no hard and fast rules for chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. But for the Gayatri Mantra, there are hard and fast rules. Then for some mantras, you have to purify the mantra every year. For some mantras, you have to declare the rishi, the meter. You know, you have, there's various preparations that you have to do. For some mantras, you have to do pranayam. You have to hold your breath. Not hold your breath and become God, but hold your breath so that you serve the mantra better. And so these are hard and fast rules. But they don't apply to the chanting of Hare Krishna. So, you know, that's what it means. No hard and fast rules for chanting Hare Krishna, but everything else. There are rules. We're bound by rules. You see? Brahmins are supposed to act like this. Okay, if you want to be a Brahmin, these are the rules. You have to live simply. You have to have no money, practically. You have to live very poorly. If you want to be a Kshatriya, you can live with silk cushions. You can have two wives. That's allowed. Even if you're a Brahmin, you can have two wives. Hooray! No, but you have to follow the rules. You see? If you're a Kshatriya, you can behave like this. So there's license there. But you have to take the responsibilities that come along with it. For every right, there is a responsibility. For every duty, there's a dharmic responsibility. For everything that you do, that you enjoy, there's a payment. This is the way it's constructed in society. So sometimes we have different types of devotees, and they have different types of attitudes. But no one is saying, actually, your varna is like this, you should work in this way. And sometimes it's helpful. Because if you're incorrectly situated in the wrong varna, you always feel that you've got to be somewhere else. You see? And sometimes we have a great turnover. We bring many, many devotees into our movement, and then a few years later, many leave. So part of the business of leading a long life in Krishna consciousness is to, as we like to say, being correctly situated. But if being correctly situated means giving a person a choice between making flower garlands and doing puja, or chopping up vegetables in the kitchen, that may not be enough of a choice. We need to improve the choices. If you improve the range of choices, if you're a bhakti yogi, then this is wonderful, because the bhakti will dominate everything else that you want to do. I know one sannyasi, and he's passed away now, Sridhar Swami. He told me that he had his Jyotish done. He had his palm read and his chart done. And the man said, by your chart, I see that you're a successful father of four children. And he laughed. He said, it never happened. He said, and he was a sannyasi till the day he died. But he said, this was interesting that someone had said, this is, so you can transcend. This is the point. This is the other half of my argument. You can transcend whatever is your varna, but you must be very strong. So Krishna comes, he comes to give direction. That everybody holds fast to their dharma and the rules. And now we have a position where no one really follows the rules of their varna because they don't know what their varna is. And they float from one position to another. And normally what people do is take up their varna as a hobby. They take up their varna as a hobby. You know, so they work in the office, but they do some gardening at home. No, your varna is you want to be a farmer, okay? They want to look after horses, but they work all day in the factory, and at night they look after a dog. Because they have a tendency to look after something with four legs and an animal that, you know. So we sublimate the thing that we were born to do because someone somewhere has decided that after the Industrial Revolution, everyone should work in big cities and mechanized industries. And it's poisoning the whole world. So we need to do what we were born to do, and then you'll be happy. So Krishna says, when you find what you were born to do, you will love doing what you're born to do, because I made you that way. Then also, once you're in what you were born to do, what you love doing, then you have to follow the rules of that varna and the rules of that ashram. Now, most of what we hear in Bhagavad Gita and the emphasis that Srila Prabhupada puts is transcending varna and ashram. But please tell me, how many people do we know that have actually transcended their varna and ashram? And is the world a better place? I say that it is much better if most people have an opportunity to engage in their varna, then we'd be much richer as a society, as an ISKCON society and others. Now, in here, we're also introduced to this term varna sankara. Sankara actually means mixed, and it means the unwanted children of mixed parentage. This was considered something that was not such a good thing. In you didn't quite ring it. I saw the rope. I saw the sort of slow motion, but it didn't quite ring. And I was thinking, this is kind of a Buddhist thing, you know, that the bell rings, but it does not ring. So you have a situation where, you have to try and understand that. Like, I was in India and I met a person whose father was a Brahmin. He's a Brahmin. His father's a Brahmin. Their father was a Brahmin, their father was a Brahmin, their father was a Brahmin. It goes back, they can trace it back 800 years. Okay. At the same time, I met a sannyasi who'd taken sannyas at the age of 12. Because he'd had his chart done, he'd had his palm read, and in there, they saw this boy will be a very powerful sannyasi. It was already prescribed. Here's the prescription. This is what Krishna has written on your hand. This is your prescription. This is what you're going to do. This is what you'll be happy doing. But Krishna says, no, you can do it for me. But this is what you'll be happy doing. So, it said, for this boy, who was one out of many thousands, this boy will be a sannyasi. So he was given sannyas at age 12. He's now 62. And he's very happy. And he's the most blissful sannyasi that you can ever be with. And, you know, he's in Madhva. In Udupi, but great respect for ISKCON and Prabhupada's teachings and everything like that. And they haven't had a sannyasi. Well, they've had two sannyasis that disappeared off the radar in 800 years. Because there's a science to it. One time I was with interesting actually. There was this man. It's getting late, isn't it? Okay. Anyway, there was this man, Hindu man, and he brought his young son to see Srila Prabhupada at Bhaktivedanta Manor. The boy was only 9, and you know, like the Hindu men do, they bring them in and say, Jai Jai Koro, Jai Jai Koro, bow down, bow down. So the boy bowed down, and the man looked at Prabhupada and said, Swamiji, please give him your blessings, give him your ashirwad, so when he grows up he can be a sadhu in your movement. And Prabhupada looked at the boy and he said, no. He said, you don't give blessings? He said, no, he's not my follower. He's not my disciple. And I was like, oh. Prabhupada said, he's my brother's disciple. The man was thinking, what's this about? He said, my brother's disciple. So anyway, then when the boy grew up, he did actually join ISKCON. He got initiated. It didn't work out. It was unsuccessful. He left. And he joined the Ramanuja Sampradaya. And now he's a professor. And he goes all over the world teaching the Sri Vaishnava philosophy. But he lives in Sri Rangam a lot of the time. And so he came and he told me the story. And he said, maybe this is what Prabhupada meant. He's not my disciple. He's my brother's disciple. But where were we? How did we get onto that? So, yes. So he told me, that boy, who's now grown up, who I knew when he was 9 years old, but now he's grown up, he's now 39. So he told me a story about a sannyasi who fell down from sannyas. And it was a real scandal all over the town of Sri Rangam, where he'd come from. This was a sannyasi who'd gone to America to preach. He'd gone to America to preach, one of the first had gone to America, flown overseas, the first in 1,000 years. He'd gone to America to preach, and he fell down. I said, oh, really, that's such a shame. How did he fall down? And the man said, everybody was talking about it. It was such a scandal, such a scandal. I said, do you mind telling me what happened? I said, I know a thing or two about sannyasi scandals. He said, he took bath from a plastic bucket. And I went, that's heavy. I can understand that was a scandal. So their rules are so tight. If you want to take sannyas and you have people bowing down to you, not that that's the reason that you do it, but in that position, the rules have to be so tight. And then if you want to be a householder, the rules are so tight. If you want to be a brahmachari, the rules are so tight. Yes, they're so tight. And if you want to be a kshatriya or vaishya or brahmin or sudra, the rules are very tight. They have very strict rules. And so Krishna comes, he comes to give all these rules. And they're all there in Shastra. Okay? And then ISKCON comes along and we go, huh, no hard and fast rules. Just chant Hare Krishna. Everything's all right. Excuse me, anything you want to do. If you had a doctor saying, oh, no hard and fast rules. You know, we can open you up, we can close you. I can do what I like, I'm a doctor. No. There are hard and fast rules for being a doctor. You can't just be a surgeon, you see. You can't just be a surgeon. If you can't just be a cook, no hard and fast rules for being a cook. What do you mean there's no hard and fast rules? Well, you just throw in the spices that you want. You just throw in any vegetable. You know, whole pumpkin, just put it in. There are rules. There's rules for everything that you do. So you have to find the rules that have been established, A, by Shastra, B, by the sadhus, by the voice of the sadhus, and C, by the guru. And then you know what the rules are. So do you know the rules for being a brahmachari? Do you know the rules for being sannyasi? Do you know the rules for being a brahmin? How is a brahmin meant to live? Someone told me a brahmin is supposed to not eat for 12 hours. He gets up at 2:30, and he's either studying or doing puja all the way through till 2:30 in the afternoon. That's what someone told me in India. Okay, these are strong rules. You see, you want to be Brahmin and be supported by people. So Krishna comes to give those rules and to remind people that there is a body of rules. But at the same time, Krishna also breaks his own rules. And that's what makes Krishna such a controversial character. Krishna says, I come so that people can have strong marriages. Because marriage is so important. Because that's the very essence of Dharma. The very essence of Dharma is what happens between men and women, because that's either binding or liberating. So creating healthy families where the children are balanced and the children are bright-eyed and they look forward to a wonderful future, engaging in their varna and ashram, and they look forward to the prospects of meeting God in another life. This, in order to do that, you have to have a good family, good strong value. And it means that when you say, I do, and you throw grains in the fire, then you mean it. And the Prabhupada said, whenever you make a promise, he said, you have to be able to prepare that, defend that promise with your very life. But mode of goodness means not that you're free from pain. Choosing to do the right thing is always painful. Not always, but mostly it can be painful. Why? Because you have to give up something that is easier to do, but it's perhaps not the right thing to do. You have to make a difficult choice. That's mode of goodness, making a difficult choice. Making mode of passion choice is you choose the easiest thing, but which in the end will cause you some difficulty. Mode of ignorance, all the choices are made for you. Your tongue makes the choice, your belly makes the choice, your genital makes the choice, your crazy mind makes the choice. And you don't think of the consequences. You don't even think of tomorrow, you see. And the lowest point of ignorance is people being intoxicated. When you're intoxicated, there's no possibility of making a decent choice. You can't even walk in a straight line. What to speak of? Think straight. You know what I'm talking about. You laughed too loudly there. We won't go into that. I come from a city where just a few months ago we had riots in the city. You must have seen it on the news, on television news. There were people just behaving like animals, really behaving like animals in the street, just putting bricks through windows and just nonchalantly walking in and destroying property, setting fire. People were still in the buildings and they were setting fire, you see. So they were Vanashankara, or Vanasankara. They were many of them were just caught up in the heat of the moment. They produced a criminal activity due to a lot of factors. Okay, unemployment, poverty, bad discipline in the home, no prospects, poor education. Okay, and the fact that they were a little bit criminally minded to begin with. Now you can't blame it all on someone else. So, and then the police were also not doing their duty. Police means to protect, you see. To protect property, to protect law and order. The law is that you can't set fire to someone's house. And if you're seen doing that, then the policeman has a duty. But what happened is that several months previously, we'd had a protest march. The G20 protest march, protesting against, bankers and the state of the world and the recession and depression. And what had happened was that the police sometimes had been a little bit too heavy. And they had pushed one man and he died. Okay? So then the police, they were being taken to court for doing the wrong thing, not behaving as policemen, acting outside the rules for policemen. So then when it came to these riots, the police were simply standing like this and watching. So the police weren't doing their prescribed duties. They were not being good karmis. Okay? And I said at the beginning that we want good karmis, because a karmi is a person who follows prescribed rules. So once you put on the policeman's uniform, if you have that kshatriya spirit, then you behave as a kshatriya. Okay, doesn't mean you go in and kill people. Kshatriya is not for killing people. Kshatriya is for defending peace and keeping peace and law and order in society. You see? So all these things depend on rules. So we have to find out the rules. But some rules, when Krishna comes, He breaks the rules himself. He dances with other men's wives. He lifts up Govardhan Hill. You see? These things can't be imitated. They can't be imitated. So Krishna is, what we say, enigmatic. Enigmatic. You can't understand Krishna except through bhakti. Except through understanding Krishna tattva. Otherwise you misunderstand Krishna. You'll think, well, Krishna was good because he did a lot of good. But then he was very bad because he danced with men's wives, and that's not good. And that's how the Christians saw it when they went to India. They saw this person called Krishna. He maybe say some good philosophy, but because he danced with it, he was immoral. He's an immoral character. Therefore, he cannot be followed. Therefore, Hinduism is bad. Therefore, Christianity is best, and we will convert all of India. So in the 1800s, they tried to convert all of India. They had 250 years. They didn't do it. You see? They didn't do it. Because when the Indians saw the Christianity, the Christians came to them and said, they said, Jesus is the Son of God. And the Hindus said, yeah, okay. Because they're thinking, well, you know, there's many, many gods, many sons of God. That's fine. So we should, he did many miracles. And they said, yes. So we should follow him. He had disciples. Oh, yeah, okay. He was a guru. That's fine. So they said, yes. So you should abandon your Hinduism and take to Christianity. They said, no. Abandon your Krishna. You see. But now what's happening is that they're going to, they're paying up to, I heard, $60 million. $60 million. The Americans are paying $60 million in India to establish television stations in which they can then broadcast in all the different languages of India. And first of all, they're going for what they call Dalits, or the untouchables, you see. And Prabhupada had an understanding of that. He said, yes, when the Brahmins stop doing what they're meant to be doing, giving religious teachings to all classes of society, including the so-called untouchables, he said, then this creates a situation where others can come in. Because people must have dharma of some kind. So if the Brahmins do not give dharma, then others will come in and give some other dharma. Yes, and it is because you cannot blame that. Everything has to be traced back to the Brahmins. When the Brahmins do their prescribed duties, then it is easier for the Kshatriyas to do their prescribed duties. And everyone down the chain. So Krishna is Krishna cannot be imitated. And there is, anusharan and anukaran. Anukaran means to follow, and anukaran means to imitate. So you can follow Krishna, but you cannot imitate Krishna. Therefore, we must know what Krishna says, and. You know, it's very interesting to note that this is not the only thing that Krishna says. These 700 verses of Bhagavad Gita are there. But that's not the only conversation that Krishna had. It's not the only conversation that Krishna had with Arjuna. If you read the Mahabharata, you find that Krishna again spoke to Arjuna. It wasn't that he didn't say anything for another 18 days. Okay? And got to the end of the battle of Kurukshetra and said, well, that was a good fight, wasn't it? He was speaking to him all the time and encouraging him in different ways. And then at the end of the Srimad Bhagavatam in the 11th canto, we find that Krishna speaks to Uddhava. And we find that the Gita to Arjuna is 700 verses, but the Gita to Uddhava is 1200 verses. And there Krishna goes into so many more details about how to serve him. Bhagavad Gita ends with Krishna saying the last shloka, the charama shloka, sarva dharmam pratyaja. You abandon everything, you surrender to me. But he doesn't get into the details. We run out of book. We run out of conversation. Okay? Because he'd already told Arjuna, this is what I want you to do. I want you to fight. And Arjuna already knew how to fight. Krishna didn't have to prescribe the rules to him. If he did, he would have said it. You see? But Arjuna was the best warrior. You see? And a lot of times we have Arjuna dressed in, you know, what looks like a sort of ISKCON Grihastha dhoti with a nice silk kurta. You know, Arjuna was tooled up. He was tooled up. Arjuna had these gloves made of lizard skin that wouldn't get chaffed when he was in armor. And so here we have Krishna saying to Arjuna that I want you to do what you know how to do. I know that you know how to do it, and I want you to do it, but do it for me. He advises him on the right course of action. Okay. Well, that's all I have to say. Except that Prabhupada, right at the end here, Prabhupada talks about everybody wanting to imitate the rasa dance. And I can tell you, even without knowing it, people try to imitate Krishna dancing, surrounded by many girls. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he found that Bishaki Sen, who was living in the forest outside the city of Jagannath Puri, he was being brought young virgins by the king. And he would dance in the night, under the moonlight, with them. They would dance around him. And then later on he would have his way with them. And the British thought that it was disgusting, but they thought that it was just part of the way that Hindus carry on anyway. So what are we going to do? But it was only when Bishaki Sen started publishing pamphlets saying that, you know, down with Queen Victoria, down with the British, let's get rid of them, that they authorized Bhaktivinoda Thakur to go in. But this is the natural tendency to imitate Krishna, even without knowing that you're doing it. There was one person who was he started his own group, his own spiritual group in England. And it was a breakaway group of a breakaway group of some meditation thing. And he eventually began to have affairs with different members of his community, the different wives of other men in the community. And it was only when the wives put their heads together and actually discussed these things that he was caught. But he didn't know anything about Krishna. But the inner tendency to try to copy Krishna and to want to be Krishna is there deep within the heart of everyone. Whether they say they do yoga or meditation, that's at the heart. To put oneself in the center. And someone just gave me the proceedings of a court case from 1862. It was called the Bombay Maharaj case. It was a very famous case. It was a British court, the Bombay Maharaj case. And it was, again, of a guru in the Ballab Sampradaya, who was dancing with his female disciples. And he would stand in the middle of the circle of female disciples pretending to play the flute. And the Christian judge was so disgusted with this that this man was a Brahmin. And you know how they dress for the court. He had the black, you know, the judge had the black and the wig. And he was going to sentence him. And accidentally, this Brahmin's, chadar was brushed against by the judge's black. And the Brahmin said, "You've contaminated me. I am a Brahmin." And the judge said to him, he said, "Touch you?" He said, "I wouldn't even touch you with a 6-foot stick." He said, "You disgust me." So this was the British judge, you know. This is all recorded. You can read all this. It's in an ancient document. If you want it, I can send it to you. It's interesting. But down through the years, that pattern of trying to imitate Krishna has always been repeated. Therefore, rules and prescriptions are put in place by Krishna that those who take on the business of Brahmins will never repeat these things. You see? But Prabhupada said they always try to repeat the things that they like to do. They always try. And therefore Prabhupada says they do half chicken. They are half chicken spiritual leaders. You know that one? Where the farmer had a chicken and at the bottom of the chicken was coming big fat eggs. And he was taking them off to market and selling them. But the chicken had a healthy appetite. And the chicken was, and was eating a lot. So the farmer said, he was a very stupid farmer. He said, well, the back end makes me money, but the front end costs me money. So I don't want the front end, but I want to keep the back end. So Prabhupada said, he took an axe and cut the chicken in half. He said, and then he was standing there waiting for the chicken to lay eggs, but there was only half a chicken. So Prabhupada said, this is called Ardha Murghi Nyaya. Ardha Murghi Nyaya, the logic of half a chicken. So similarly, people like to, they like to do the nice things, they like to dance with the gopis, but lifting Govardhan Hill, they don't want to do, because that's very strenuous. So they want to copy the bits of Krishna that suits them. Oh, dancing with other men's wives. That's very nice. I get that. I understand that. I think me and Krishna are on the same page here. But lifting Govardhan Hill, no, that's not interesting. So similarly, the Sahajas, they like that. They like Krishna in Vrindavan, but they don't like Krishna in Kurukshetra. And therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he said, when I'm in my last days, he said, you please build my bhajan kutir at Kurukshetra. Because in Kurukshetra, I'll remember Krishna and Radha in a mood of separation. He said, this will be my final meditation. Okay. Thank you very much. See you tomorrow. Arrivo.